Welcome back to the Environmental Law Monitor. I'm your host, Daniel Pope. This podcast is brought to you by Bracewell LLP's Environment, Lands, and Resources Practice Group, and it's a place for thoughtful conversations. We have conversations ranging from the latest developments to perennial topics like litigation, enforcement, and compliance assurance. We're glad you're spending some time with us today.
It's 2024. We're glad you're tuning back in. And we've got a lot of great episodes coming up, and we're excited to get back into your iPhones, your Androids, whatever you use. I'm going to do something that I don't usually do. One of my New Year's resolutions is to be more sharing and inclusive. So I'm going to throw some hosting duties in the direction of Whit Swift, a partner here in our Austin office. I hope I don't regret it, but no, Whit's been great. He's been on the podcast before. And he's going to walk us through in a conversation on the Houston, Galveston, Brazoria area emissions credits and where we are. So Whit, why don't you introduce that topic a little bit more and introduce our special guest today?
Great. Thank you very much, Daniel. I appreciate your willing to take the risk on allowing me to co-host with you here as we kick off the new season. I suggested this podcast topic to Daniel toward the end of last year after attending a conference that Kyle Breeze, our guest today, and his company A New Climate put on back in November. They have this annual emissions credit and carbon credit conference, and it really covers a couple things. First, this bucket of carbon credit issues, which is not what I'm interested in talking with Kyle about today, probably material for another podcast, should Kyle be willing to join us again. But second, wholly apart from the discussion you see in trade press and even mainstream media about carbon credits, is emissions credits in Texas, primarily focused on ozone non-attainment areas and most importantly, the Houston-Galveston area, as you mentioned, Daniel. And he gave a fascinating presentation there, and I thought it had some really interesting insight about the markets and also just project planning strategy in general. And so I asked Kyle and suggested to you, Daniel, that we bring him on for a podcast. So here we are.
Welcome, Kyle.
Yeah, thanks, guys, for having me. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Kyle, what do you do? How long have you been doing it? And then we'll jump back into some of this stuff.
Yeah, fair. So it's funny. I know a lot of people in the space, and people ask me that all the time. I'm like, well, I'm an emission credit broker. They're like, great. But so what do you do exactly, right? It's like, well, I've been told, you know, I tell people I buy and sell pollution just for the kind of the average, maybe the law student. I buy and sell pollution. That's the easiest thing. Or maybe the more sophisticated answer for our audience would be, well, I help sit down with companies' emissions portfolios and help them plan on how to overcome their challenges and maybe cash in on some opportunities.
Whit, before we jump into the substance of the discussion, you mentioned already emissions credits and carbon credits, and we've had plenty of credits talk on this podcast. Over the past year or so, we've talked about the 45Q tax credit, which I realize is not a Clean Air Act thing, right? But we've also talked about, I think in passing, mitigation credits. We've talked about renewable identification numbers and the fuels credits that are associated with the renewable fuels program. So can both of you talk about when we talk about emissions credits in the HGB area?
Yeah, I'm happy to give a little background that will hopefully set the table for what Kyle can talk about as far as current market and market strategy. But yeah, when we're talking emissions credits here today, this is an emissions credit program that's really been part of the ozone compliance strategy in Texas for decades at this point. And it's focused, and we're talking about emissions credits, which is basically, it represents the emissions of a particular pollutant for over a particular year, like the right to emit a certain pollutant over a year and expressed in terms of tons per year. And there are multiple types of credit programs that we have here in Texas. One kind would be the cap and trade type of program, where it's an allowance where they've determined, okay, these are the amount of emissions that the area can have in order to make progress towards attainment or reach attainment. And it's capped at that amount, and it allows trading within that area in order to seek the most efficient reductions. That cap and trade stuff is really different than what we're talking about with Kyle here, which is this emissions credits that are primarily used as offsets in air permitting. And in particular, for major projects in the Houston area, projects that exceed this major source threshold or major modification threshold, you've got to get offsets that are designed to offset the new pollutants you're adding to the airshed. So for example, say you're making a change to a project in that 8-county area, and the project will have an increase of 40 tons per year of an ozone precursor like volatile organic compounds or VOC. And the two pollutants that we'll be talking about here are VOCs and NOx, or nitrogen oxides, those being the ozone precursors. But say your project has got a 40 ton per year increase in VOC. Well, as part of the requirements to authorize that project in an ozone non-attainment area like Houston, you've got to offset those increases. So the idea is that, well, I'm adding 40 tons per year of VOC to the airshed. Well, in order to get permission to build that project or to make that change, I've got to offset or reduce the VOCs going into the airshed by over 40 tons. And so the way that that program is implemented in Texas is through these emissions credits. There's something that you generate voluntarily by, for example, the voluntary installation of a pollution control device, or the shutdown of a source, making some other operational change that reduces your emissions. But you go through this process and you get those certified by the TCEQ. You know, they vet it to make sure it's legit, to make sure it's a reduction that wasn't required of you by some rule anyways. But you get these certificates that represent these credits of a voluntary reduction. And those credits have great value, and they are traded on the market largely for people looking to build and expand to satisfy that offset requirement. And that market, buying and selling these things to allow for expansions to happen along the Houston Ship Channel and other areas in this Houston, Galveston, Brazoria ozone non-attainment area, that's the real driver for these credits and why they have such value, and what I think is real interesting to hear from Kyle about.
Yes, yeah, so one of the trends and themes that actually I think is going to start to really take foot in 2024 is, Daniel, you mentioned there's all kinds of credits out there, and that's very true. And unfortunately, very rarely do you come across someone or a firm or a company that feels like that I would look at them and say, yeah, they got a handle on everything. Okay. They know where all these different markets are. And more importantly, they know where all these different gotchas are. So, you know, you talked about the renewable fuel standard stuff, and that's a big driving force for a lot of, you know, alternative fuel projects, et cetera. And you layer on top of that IRA and some of these other tax incentives that are kind of carbon-based, right? And what I would tell you is these old school NOx and VOC stuff that we're going to talk about, and maybe even hint at PM2.5 going forward, which is another type of credit, particulate matter. These are some gotchas in certain parts of the country that some companies want to go build some of these other types of projects to cash in on these other incentives. If they don't go check these boxes, granted, these are only $5 or $10 or $20 million boxes in some cases, but those $5 or $10 or $20 million boxes could absolutely sabotage a $1 billion project that took their eye off the ball. There's different types of emission credit programs. One is kind of a construction-based program. Okay, you want to go build something big, you got to go get offsets. And just for all the law students out there, Daniel, actually, when you build something, it's kind of counterintuitive. You build something brand new, it actually helps drive emissions down. Why? Because you have to go get additional emissions above and beyond what you're going to build. So if you had a 100-ton project, you actually have to go get 130 tons, for example, and 30 of those tons just go away. You retire them to the benefit of the environment. Right. So by building stuff, we actually help reduce emissions over time. But in some cases, like in Houston, we find that doesn't drive down stuff fast enough. So we come up with other programs like the cap and trade program, which is more not necessarily a construction program. It's more of like an operational program, kind of a sister thing, which also helps drive down emissions from a regulatory perspective. So it's almost like an investment advisor, right? Here's your portfolio. What do you want to do? What are you afraid of? You know, my wife, you can follow her lead. When I met her family for the first time, she said, just tell everybody you're a mechanic. you know, no, nobody understands the space. But I am an emission credit broker, and I sit down with companies and we look at challenges and opportunities. And a lot of times people aren't looking at their emissions as like a feedstock on how they can grow their business in a certain area or how they continue to operate in their business in a certain area. And that's a new paradigm shift that's going to have to happen, because the price of these feedstocks, so to speak, are going to be paramount to how you do business for the next 10 or 20 years. And that's not just including NOx and VOC. That's going to be including carbon and all of that whole discussion as well. So my background going forward, I didn't answer the when. How long have I been doing this? I'm a chemical engineer by degree, graduated 06, spent about a decade doing air consulting stuff of various, all types, primarily in Texas, but across the country a little bit. But understanding the game is a combination of understanding regulatory stuff, technical stuff, your internal capabilities, how your company defines risk, what's the marketing, what's the market look like, what's your capital project horizon, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not just one thing. It's trying to look at everything comprehensively.
So Kyle, you mentioned, you know, getting into this, people bringing up just the value of VOC in the Houston area. And that's why this is so important. That's why people hire you guys. And that's what makes these such an important element of project planning in the Houston Galveston area. But just to give people some perspective so they know what we're talking about, I'd like to talk a bit about the value and kind of what's happened to these credits, the value of these credits over recent years. And then what's really interesting is the things that might impact the value of those credits going forward. But to put a little bit of context around it, looking back at the past decade or few years, what's happened with emissions credits and the value of emissions credits for these Houston growth projects in recent years?
Yeah, great question, Whit. So I'm going to take a step back and differentiate value, because I think you'll find something interesting about value versus price. Because I think the question is more geared along towards price. But I do have a data point that's worth sharing about value. So there's a saying that history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it often rhymes, right? So if we go back in time, this isn't the first time we've come across. The reason we're talking about emission credits today is because there's a scarcity issue, right? And the price action's reflecting as such, and it becomes a big project planning concern. But you go back not even 10 years ago, Whit, and this we went through the same phenomenon. And so we looked into this stuff, I don't know, 8 to 10 years ago, and this is nothing formal that we put together, but we did go research all the major projects in both Texas and Louisiana that triggered non-attainment new source review for air permitting. And we looked at how many credits did those projects collectively need. And I'd have to go dust this stuff off. I don't have it right in front of me, but I do remember the takeaway. We looked at that CapEx number and divided it amongst NOx plus VOC, and we came to the value component of this, that every credit is worth $30 million in CapEx, okay? Because these are big, big projects, right? Usually $500 million, $1 billion plus. Sometimes they get even bigger than that. And you add all that stuff up, they're going to have big sources of emissions. And again, in an NSR program, just because it says you have big sources of emissions, when you start dealing with offsets, emissions for the area actually go down. So I don't want to belittle that. That's an important point, especially for the law students. But in terms of value, it's about $30 million in CapEx. And that number is about 8 years old. So it might be $40 or $50 million in CapEx today. I don't know. I haven't refreshed that in a long time. But in terms of price, Houston's one of the most interesting markets in the country, because we just have all the components to make a market go. You have huge population. You have a huge petrochemical and refining corridor. You have lots of activity. We have a good state to do business in. So there's a lot of incentives to come build in Texas, right? It's what makes the market go versus some other places across the country. The market could, in fact, be tighter. Like Dallas, for example, the supply in Dallas is something like 2 tons of VOC and 10 tons of NOx total. That's it, as it stands today. I mean, that's nothing. You can't build anything for that, right? You need 30, 40, 50 tons at a minimum. But the thing about Dallas is, who wants to go build in Dallas, right? It's a very specific set of industries. It's not the customers we're talking to today. And so Houston is one of the more interesting type of markets in the country. And we're talking about price points today that are $100,000 to $200,000 a ton, depending on what you want to talk about. And we can dive into the specifics. And I know that sounds expensive, So for example, let's say you have a 50 ton VOC need and you need, and VOC is going at $200,000 a ton. That's $10 million, right? That's nothing to sneeze at. And so, and the problem with a lot of the commercial folks that you talk to, not necessarily the environmental folks that we work with on a day-to-day basis, but you go try to talk to their commercial departments within their companies and they look at these emission credit costs and they're like, this is the definition of unproductive capital. Because what am I actually getting by spending $10 million on a certificate that you said earlier that's 50 tons of VOC? What am I actually getting? And what you're actually getting is you're getting the right to build in Houston because of the way the non-attainment rules have played out over the past and Chapter 116 rules have played out over the past 20, 30 years, right? That's all that's left. But when I say even $100,000 to $200,000 a ton VOC, if you go back 10 years ago, back when we had the last pinch point, prices were actually more expensive than they are today, Whit, in nominal terms. We actually peaked in 2013, 2014 time period where we hit $300,000 a ton VOC and NOx ERCs. And then if we talk about MEC perpetual allowances, which we might may or may not want to talk about, we go back to the mid 2000s and 2007, 2008 time period, and MEC actually peaked at $190,000 a ton. So you fast forward to today, again, that's nominal terms. You fast forward to today in 2024 and VOC, depending on who you talk to, the last transactions have been $130,000 to $150,000 a ton. There's really been no NOx ERC transactions, but you would presumably assume they're kind of in the same boat. You got to go back, I think, 2 years to see a NOx ERC transaction. And then MEC is a little bit all over the place. And I want to say MEC is all over the place because one of the questions we were going to potentially talk about is reactive versus strategic buyers. And so MEC was as cheap as $75,000 to $80,000 a ton for some and as expensive as $125,000 to $135,000 a ton for others. So again, kind of level setting everything, it's expensive. It's expensive to build in Houston. But actually today as it stands right now, it's actually less expensive today in nominal terms than it was 10 years ago. And that might surprise some people.
So if we're less expensive now, but I know that when we've talked about this, the concern is that we're approaching a pinch point, you know, something where the market will be unpredictable, could change significantly. What are the factors in your view that put us at this particular point in time right now where the market deserves particular attention?
Yeah. So Daniel, I think, alluded to it earlier in this episode where he's talking about if you're a generator of these credits, you want to go generate these credits to put them into the market for sale. But you got to think about who generates these types of things, guys. If it's the big petrochemical customers, they're not in the business of generating credits to go sell them to their competitors, right? The only reason they're going to go generate reductions is probably to go free up that $30 million in CapEx per ton that we talked about earlier for their own purposes and their own expansions. So when you look at, wow, we have all this capability to go generate these credits, why aren't we just doing it? It's because it's a competitive advantage and no one's going to just sell away their competitive advantage. So then you look at the other sellers that are out there like, well, we're going to generate credits to go sell to the market. And that's cool. And I'm gonna switch over to demand and I'll switch back to the supply component. On a demand basis for VOC, for example, it's pretty simple when you kind of go look at the past 10 or 11 years of history. On a demand basis, we basically need about 200 tons per year of demand for VOC credits. And that goes up or down about plus or minus 100 tons. Now, those numbers aren't exact, but it makes it kind of easy for discussion purposes. So in an average year, we need 200 tons of VOC. On an uptick year, we need 300 tons of VOC. And on a down year, when let's say the economy is uncertain or whatever, we still need 100 tons of VOC. So that's the demand component. And the demand component doesn't really matter about price. Why? Because again, the demand represents billions of dollars of CapEx. Those commercial guys that are the project directors of those projects, they don't really care if an emission credit costs 10 or 20 million. I know that sounds crazy, but they're worried about $1 billion spend, right? So demand is what demand is, or kind of almost regardless of where we are in terms of price. But supply is different. When you want to incentivize those generators to go generate more credits, the price has to speak to them. And so what we see in the VOC world is $200,000 to $250,000 a ton VOC prices speaks to sellers where they're going to start spitting out credits. At least that's what it was in the past 10 years. Whereas once we get below 200,000 and once we get below 150, there's still sellers that are generating credits because that's what they're going to do. But it goes down by a factor of like 50%, man, or 75%. And so where we are today is we've had multiple years where the price of VOC has been sufficiently low that we haven't been sending that signal to the suppliers to go generate these things, right? And demand is staying constant. People say, well, demand's going to go up and down. It is, but it's relatively constant in that threshold I told you about earlier. And so now we're down to like less than 50 tons of VOC that remain that are readily available today. And the price point, the highest we've had in recent say 12 to 18 months, I believe is $156,000 a ton. That's the highest price point we've had. And so that signal hasn't hit the suppliers yet to say, go generate more, right? And so we're at a pinch point. And the analogy is the same on the NOx ERC side too, right? But we're talking about VOC because we're a petrochemical sector. That's usually the more interesting pollutant to talk about. But we're at a situation where we're down to the bottom of the barrel. There hasn't been a signal to go generate more credits, and demand is at least going to be constant, even if it's low, even if we only need 100 tons next year, we only have 50. And so we would just expect prices to rise substantially to incentivize those sellers. And then on top of that, as you know, it's difficult to get anything approved at the agency level, which to go get these reductions approved as ERCs is an approval process that goes to the agency. And so that has a lag time associated with it between 6, 12, sometimes 18 months. So even if we wanted to start you and me today to go generate this stuff, it could still be a year, 2.5 years before we see them actually hit the supply side of the equation.
I'm curious, you talk about the signal that will trigger a change in the market. You know, what is the signal that suddenly folks need more credits than are readily available on the market right now? Is that signal typically someone approaching anew and saying, hey, help me, I'm going to need 80 tons of NOx or VOC. How can I get there? How is that signal reach the market so that folks who have perhaps a latent, you know, I guess that's because that's what you've got, right? Is you've got somebody in industry out there has got basically a latent emissions reduction project that they could implement, or maybe a less productive part of their process that they could shut down if they knew it was worth enough on the back end. But like, how does that signal make it into the generator market to say, hey, the value of these is going to be worth your while?
Yeah, Whit, that's a great question. So anyone who will listen to this crazy guy you're talking to, I will go yell to anybody and everybody, hey, go generate these things. It's worth it. I promise. Please do it. And then if they don't want to listen to this crazy guy, hopefully listen to more polished advisors such as yourself to go listen to it. But to your point, it's such a thinly traded market, and the action is there's an inherent delay in everything that some companies are going to get upside down. And it is a tail wag the dog issue. It just is. You and I are talking about environmental issues. And environmental issues in general are a tail wag the dog issue when you're talking about capital projects, right? So we can go sit in front of CFO of a major company and say, hey, we have a $25 to $50 million pinch point for you. And they're like, okay, well, talk to me in 2025 after we've addressed the $500 million and the $300 million issues that are ahead of that, right? And so that's what kind of creates these dynamics, Whit, is when I try to think of a good analogy about how supply and demand meet in the credit markets. And the best I could say, it's like a sine and cosine wave for all of us nerds out here.
So, and I'm curious, so we've talked about one way that you'll work with somebody, which would be, again, a company that wants to do a project comes to you and says, I need to get X number of credits for my offsets here. Help me do it. But you also talked about kind of a different aspect of the business where you referred to yourself as more of a, I forget, investment advisor or whatever the term was that you used, where talking with folks about the value of what they've got. Is that something that you're doing as well? As far as talking with folks, advising them, okay, well, they say, hey, this is what I've got. And how can I use, or what is the emissions credit market? How does the emissions credit market impact my strategy here? Or should it, you know, is that kind of a sit down where you go in and say, hey, this is what you could expect from the markets. Take this into account as to what you want to do with your operations.
Absolutely. So we talk to buyers and we talk to sellers. I mean, we talk to everybody. I mean, think about it from like a real estate agent. It doesn't matter if you're buying a house or you're selling a house. It's if you want someone to come help you think through that process, there's all kinds of questions that can be asked. So for example, one question I think is material to not just this, but will translate over well to the carbon side of the equation is you have to have a good sense of what are your internal reduction capabilities and timing. Just as, you know, if we speak to the permitting folks, if you're trying to line up your netting table for a big project, sometimes you can control the variables on the netting table, and sometimes you just can't because it's got bigger reasons for why it's on the netting table at that period in time. And so if you're doing the same thing from a credit perspective, are you trying to monetize these things? We talk about that. But on the demand side, for example, let's say you want to operate in Houston for another 30 years, Whit, Okay. And that means, you know, the price of pollution is going to go up, basically. That's most the most likely outcome. The price of staying in Houston is going to have rising costs due to emissions. Well, what I can do is I can go look at all my sources, figure out, well, what can I do in all these sources to reduce emissions? How many emissions do I get? What's the price of that? What's my price per ton? Right. And then I can look at that versus the market. And then I can be, you know, it's a good segue to the strategic buyer, right? If I know my basis to go generate VOC reductions is $165,000 a ton inside the fence line that would normally just show up on my netting table. I know that's my basis, but I got some stuff coming down the line that I need to be prepared for. Well, if the market for VOC is $100,000 a ton, that's a heck of a bargain relative when you compare that relative to your own internal capabilities. And so if you can get as a company to that level and start thinking about it that way on NOx and VOC, well, guess what? That also translates over to carbon pretty well, because the carbon conversation is going to be very, very similar, not in the next year, but maybe in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, that reminds me of a discussion we have had in the context of a particular company where you were offering some advice on the value of, I guess this was in the voluntary carbon markets, and talking about how there's a certain order of magnitude of reductions that you need to make it worth your while in those markets at this point. The reduction has to be of such magnitude that it's worth the cost of going through the process of generating them, getting them certified, and doing all those things, such that it really weeds out a lot of projects that might have an incentive to reduce a lot of carbon emissions. But at least the way the markets stand right now, the economics don't support doing it for the sake of generating some kind of carbon offset credit that somebody could use. And I'm guessing you've got a more defined market in Houston, Galveston area if you're transitioning away from carbon and back to a VOC and NOx. But I guess in some ways it's the same thing where somebody's just looking at, you know, okay, this is again what I've got, and is this reduction worth doing from a marketable credit standpoint? Or do I sit on it based on what my future plans are and either save it for my own use or wait and hope it's worth, you know, 50 times again, you know, or 50% more if I wait and did it in 2026?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Whit. It is an optimization game. Again, I want to preface this by saying we are talking about a tail wag the dog issue. And so there's a couple things. Here's another controversial thing that's kind of worth saying, that having higher baselines of emissions is generally a competitive advantage when you're talking about trying to maneuver in projects and growth in certain areas, right? And that may be counterintuitive to what some folks are aware of, but having higher baselines is a competitive advantage. So you don't just want to give that up for nothing, right? You want to make sure it aligns with internal growth projects or some type of big monetization event, period. So what I do want to take a step back is I made a note when you guys were talking about shutdowns versus controls earlier. If you can imagine, these programs have been implemented for the past 30 plus years. And I did something at one point where again, I went and looked at, okay, here's the emission credit program. What other programs are impacting emission credits? Because they have to be voluntary. You guys mentioned that earlier. Well, what makes them not voluntary? If other regulations come in that lower the floor, okay? So I went and looked at all the NOx programs in Texas and all the VOC programs in Texas. And don't quote me on this because it's kind of roundabout numbers, but it was like 45 additional NOx regulations and 55 additional VOC regulations that you kind of have to navigate through to still be voluntary, right? And so when you're looking at all this stuff, if you've had decades of 45 and 55 different types of NOx and VOC regulations, there's not a lot of control projects left. There's just not. So in this day and age, about 80 to maybe even 90% of all reductions are a result of shutdowns. So now you're literally looking at emissions from a balance sheet perspective. What's the value of the emissions associated with this unit relative to me shutting down the unit versus relatively incorporating other just more traditional metrics into how that unit's performing. But sometimes if you're looking for an exit or looking for a reason to shut down a particular unit, sometimes emissions could be the exit you're looking for. So we have conversations like that as well. And then to the extent you can control the timing, fantastic. But a lot of those discussions, you don't get a lot of tolerance on when you can execute something like that.
I guess that goes to a point that you were talking about earlier, which is being reactive versus proactive on some of this. And I guess that's one of the factors that a company is looking at in making those decisions. Thinking about the credit implications of a change like that or a shutdown is an example of being proactive in that assessment as opposed to reactive. And the same thing from a purchaser perspective, somebody who's in there anticipates needing credits at some point is, again, being the difference that how you can position yourself proactive versus reactive, maybe looking at what your plans are for your site, your operation in the near future, or if you have other sites in the area where you could use your own credits from a different site in HGB or relying on the open market. To me, that's an interesting thing that you help people with that market perspective is, okay, timing, when to enter the market, whether you're a seller or a buyer, and kind of how to be a proactive market participant versus a reactive market participant. Because I work from the environmental side, I'm seeing it. I'm seeing the little, as you talked about, the $20 million part, not the $500 million part. So things that look like a big deal to me, maybe they really aren't the driver for the project. They aren't driving the project decisions, even though they seem like a huge deal in my perspective, since I'm working on the permitting. But that's a real interesting aspect of it is sort of taking somebody and how to make them a strategic participant in that market.
And just strikes me that if you're not taking that strategic angle, even though it is with a smaller total value, $20 million, as opposed to the total value of the project. Kyle, as you were talking, I'm just sort of have this image of like a barrel full of emissions credits. And you know, we're taking one out here, one out there, and there's no induction, right? There's no incentive to start filling that barrel back up with new credits. You might be at a point if we scrape that barrel too much, right? Where, well, now you just have a pretty hard regulatory bar and it's not really a question of cost anymore. There's nothing on the market to purchase. So that's just fascinating to me. And I think it's another example of just why you've got to be strategic about it. Because if you react, you know, you may not be able to take the steps you would have otherwise preferred to take.
Let me jump in just because, Whit, how do you become proactive? And I'll give you a real hard data from last year so that you know kind of in real time what we're talking about. But one aside, when you guys are talking about millions of dollars, I literally have had this conversation twice with potential sellers. I'm like, guys, you could sell this and make $1 million. And the response was, yeah, Kyle, but it's just $1 million. So I don't really want to go through that. And so like as individuals, that's mind blowing. But at the company level, there's reasons why that may or may not make sense. Okay. So we're talking what's relative to what, but to the point of what does it cost you to be reactive versus proactive. And so the MECT perpetual market last year, Whit, is a great case study on being proactive versus reactive. And I'm not going to dissect into who did what and where what, but I'll just say our clients who were clearly had been working to be proactive. If you look at the whole MECT market, there is 95 tons that were bought proactively. That's not a lot. 95 tons bought proactively. Their average weighted cost was $77,600 a ton. So 95 tons at 77,000. There was another 97.2 tons of demand in the MECT perpetual market. So pretty close, 95 versus 97. These were not proactive buyers. They were reactive buyers because they had projects and let's just say not Whit or Kyle's advice, right? And so they ended up paying average weighted price of $126,200 a ton. So it just last year alone, looking at one isolated market, you could suggest that being reactive could cost you a 60% premium versus being proactive. That's a pretty healthy premium.
And I'm curious, you talk about that distinction and a proactive versus a reactive. And so in that example, when you talk about a reactive buyer, is that somebody who essentially, I guess, you know, just showed up and said, I need 20 tons and basically went, put in a notice to the TCEQ and filed something saying, hey, I'm a prospective buyer. They've got some credit.
So they kind of have a good handle on different scenarios and how it's going to play out over the next 5 to 10 years. And that's who the proactive type of buyer would. Again, someone who's leaning probably pretty heavily on folks like you and me to help them get to that point. And that's the best way I could probably frame it up today.
So Kyle, it seems to me that if I'm listening to this podcast, maybe I've got time to add a New Year's resolution that I can actually keep to pay attention to these emissions markets, to the price of a credit, and to factor that proactively in. And maybe at the end of the year, I'll be able to say, great, I converted from being a reactive market participant to a strategic market participant. What's something else you can leave us with as we roll out?
So a couple things, Daniel. One is what you just said kind of reminds me of, I saw a postcard at the post office and it was a brief guide to avocados. Okay. And I've told this to a couple of my clients. I said, brief guide to avocados. On day one, it's too green. Day two, the avocado's too green. Day three, the avocado's too green. Day three and a half, it's too late, right? So like the brief guide to avocados is a good analogy that if this is meaningful to you and helping you trying to figure out how you are going to evaluate risk and identify the risk questions for your company, you got to get started on it sooner. The good news is most of the stuff you're familiar with, regulatory policy, technical issues, right? Your own internal capabilities, you know that stuff. It's just you might not have taken the time to roll that up into a comprehensive evaluation of how you're going to play that versus your capital projects and your concerns in the market. Okay. And so the last thing I'll say is it's worth doing that exercise sooner than later. Cause again, the stuff we're talking today about NOx and VOC, it bleeds into the decarbonization conversation. That is going to be a big issue the next 2 to 5 years on how companies are decarbonizing at the corporate level. And a lot of these themes are going to be perfectly transferable from doing that exercise in a place like Houston.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Whit. Thank you, Kyle, for joining us. We'll definitely have you back to check in on the status of these markets and what you're seeing. So thank you for stopping by, and thank you to our listeners for starting off a new year with us. We have some great podcasts coming at you, and we'll talk to you soon.